This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, even if not in bubbles anymore. I'm Samuel Mann, and I am joined today by Tim Lynch. Kia ora, Tim.
Kia ora, Sam. How are you today, Sam?
I'm very well indeed. It is good to be talking with you. We've had a long session of Mawira's master students, and now we're not doing that, but instead we're doing doctoral students.
I hope no one compares us.
Remind us what you're studying.
Yes, and that's an excellent question. What aren't I studying, it feels like, at the moment? My doctoral studies at the moment are surrounding the communication of climate change, particularly for culinary arts students and what it could mean for restaurants. So my thesis as it stands at the moment is being split up into three areas, and that's following the path of hope, anger, hope and action. So these first interviews are all around that notion of anger and how climate change, eco-anger, is forcing people to do things that in other times, other parts of history, they may not have done.
So you've been talking with people who are angry?
I have.
Is it angry men waving at clouds?
Not at all, actually. The two ladies, Rosemary and Jen, that I spoke to, are both retired. Very well spoken, very eloquent. In fact, it almost felt like I should be having scones and cups of tea with them rather than discussing how do you get your hand when it's been super glued to a motorway in Wellington off, and is it scary when you concrete yourself to a motorway? And these are conversations that I know I certainly don't have with my parents. So it was interesting, fascinating conversations. With Kyle, conversations around what motivates people to protest. A lot of his work is surrounding this notion of the decolonisation of protesting, which is a kind of fascinating idea if you think about it. What does a hikawe mean if it's being done by Pākehā? What does it look like if Pākehā start adopting some of the protest movements that Māori have traditionally done? So yes, I have been speaking with angry people. So the first of the interviews is with Kyle, and Kyle is from Wellington. I meant to catch him when he was down here before the floods, luckily, as he was down here for an ice hockey tournament, and his work, I'll let him explain it, but really his postdoctoral work that he's doing at the moment is surrounding the notion of counter-terrorism and also looking at sort of right-wing political movements in New Zealand. And I started talking to him really because I wanted to sort of frame this idea of eco-anger or anger that stems out from this great existential crisis which is facing us at the moment. And we'll go into more depth later when we talk to Rosemary and Jen later on. But I'll let Kyle take it over from here and he'll introduce himself.
So Kyle Matthews, I'm a research fellow at Victoria University. I work in a research unit called Hei Whenua Tarakura. It's the National Centre of Research Excellence for Preventing and Countering Violent Extremism. And we do work in kind of two things. One is what it says on the box, preventing and countering violent extremism. How do we think about hate and violence in society and prevent it? But you also have a role of social cohesion. So how do we So Hei Whenua Tarukura kind of translates as a peaceful land. So how do we help make New Zealand a society in which there is less hate, less division, racial division, ethnic division, those sort of things. So that's my current job. I've been there about 9-10 months, something like that. And I do work on things like hate speech legislation or the lack of it, how we think about security as a collective thing, you know, in terms of addressing issues like poverty and alienation from society and trauma and violence, rather than kind of counter-terrorism is often a violent activity. You find people and you arrest them and you lock them up and interrogate them, and you know, has this whole, or shoot them and kill them or bomb their country and all those sort of things. How we think about those things differently. So my PhD was kind of nominally about Extinction Rebellion in New Zealand, particularly in here in Dunedin. So I was kind of embedded in the local group as a participant, observer, scholar, activist. So both kind of doing research and taking the notes and trying to do interviews and stuff like that, but also actively involved in the group, participating in their meetings and activities and those sort of things. And I frame my PhD as kind of thinking about what is the intersection between this kind of concept of radicalism or being radical and what we know about knowledge, kind of typically in Foucauldian terms, how knowledge is kind of entangled with power and how we use knowledge in relationships and contests over collective activity and those sort of things. And in particular with Extinction Rebellion, because it's from the UK, this kind of process of taking something from a colonising country and bringing it to a colonised country, and the assumption that it could just kind of be planted here without modifying it all, thinking about what it means in New Zealand, what is the relationship between that and the treaty, Indigenous people, partnership, all those sort of issues. And the XR in New Zealand, we kind of went through this process of, after initially transplanting it, then modifying it and trying to think about how do we take this model and transform it in some way so that it's kind of more appropriate for Aotearoa rather than just something that could be applied in any country in the world and you can't do that. So they did things like translating some of the elements of XR, the demands and principles, into Te Reo Māori, putting them through a Te Reo Māori lens, so they kind of rewrote them, adding demands which are about Indigenous rights, treaty rights, the United Nations Declaration Rights of Indigenous People, those sort of things. So kind of observing those processes as well as the actions that people do and how knowledge influences kind of the XR story. How does that influence how people enact their radicalism within that group, given what they know and what they learn and how they learn over that period of time?
Was that transition of taking a protest movement from the United Kingdom with an established way of operating to New Zealand a smooth transition?
No. It was, I mean, I'm writing a journal article about this at the moment, and we talk about the challenges that faced, both kind of challenges in terms of time, and it took a lot of effort, mostly for Māori activists and some Pākehā supporters, to kind of get these changes through, and there was kind of quite a bit of frustration with that. But also there were quite a few Pākehā activists who felt really challenged by that in a number of ways, kind of threatened by trying to think in Te Reo Māori rather than in English, and, oh, that's going to be less effective if we talk to people that way. People kind of having, I guess I'd call kind of a zero-sum game approach to social change. If we're doing work on A, and then we turn our attention to B, that diminishes A. So there was a lot of people worried climate change is this existential problem. It's the end of the world coming at us real fast. We have to fix climate change. If we start to think about colonisation and race, we're actually diminishing our work on climate change rather than thinking about how colonisation and climate change are interrelated, that colonisation is about extraction, the burning of fossil fuels, you know, the withdrawal of wealth from one territory and taking it back to the imperial centre, all those sort of things, which we know are kind of entangled with what we're doing to our planet as well. And so some people really struggled to get their heads around this, or couldn't get their heads around it. Some people left the group, some couldn't remain involved, they just kind of felt like they had to go in their own direction. But for some people it was really empowering. We saw some people who were initially challenged and then they kind of got on board, I think, and started to think more about what does it mean to be Pākehā in Aotearoa. What does the treaty mean for me in terms of, you know, I'm a citizen here, so I have some sort of relationship with Māori across the Treaty of Waitangi and as part of the Crown Māori, and starting to think about those. So it was a bit of a mixed bag. When XR talked about kind of this, it had this big thing about we draw on social science, we know protest and non-violent protest is really effective. They drew on kind of Gandhi, the suffrage movement in the UK, the civil rights movement in America, all kind of vaguely, largely similar non-violent protest kind of models, mostly effective. XR would promote itself, it would use those examples to say, look, this is how effective protest is going to work. We're going to be disruptive. This is how we're going to achieve change. We're going to force governments to do things they don't want to just because we're going to be really annoying and that sort of stuff. In New Zealand, you know, we have this kind of proud tradition of social change as well, both Indigenous, you think about Parihaka, going back 150 years now, but also, Bastion Point. While XR was going on here, up at Uhumato in Auckland, there was this Indigenous Pākehā mixed group occupying this land and doing kind of pretty traditional Māori land occupation, but also thinking about how Māori and Pākehā would work together and how they would make decisions, that sort of stuff. So this really interesting model. And that didn't have a big influence over XR in the early stage. There wasn't it certainly was initially a model of we're going to do exactly what they did in the UK. UK, for example, they had this thing where they said we're going to go to capital cities, we're going to have thousands of people, we're going to occupy a central space. You had these occupations of bridges and Trafalgar Square and kind of... and we're going to stay there for days, weeks, and eventually they're going to come in, they're going to mass arrest us, and that's going to clog up the policing, the jails, the criminal courts, that sort of stuff. And we're going to keep doing this, and eventually it's going to overwhelm the system, and they have to concede. It kind of draws on this guy called Gene Sharp, who's this non-violent theorist. And there's some validity to that, but when that came to New Zealand, for example, like the first time XR had a big protest was in Wellington in October 2019, and people from all over the country came together. They occupied a central street in Wellington. The police sat back and didn't arrest them and just kind of watched them because it was just kind of a side street. And everyone was like, they're supposed to arrest us. What do we do now? And so then they had this kind of hurried discussion after several hours, and they're like, well, we can either go and admit this is a failure, or... And so they walked along the Lambton Quay outside Parliament, sat down in the major intersection, blocking busway and cars and stuff, and basically the police, we're not moving until you arrest us. And the police came along, arrested 40 people, processed them, released them. Nothing magical happened, but there was this kind of trapped in this idea that this is how you do it because that's what people in the UK said, and we were promised that this would do it, and people were like, well, I came here to get arrested, that's how I contribute to social change, I want to do it because that's the answer I've been given. So there was this this kind of understand this knowledge that came to people, and it made promises which weren't necessarily true, but they were so desperate for answers to this serious, you know, existential problem that they feel they had to take responsibility for because the government wasn't doing it, nobody else was doing it. Thankfully, someone gave us the answer, so we're going to go put that answer into action and that'll fix it. And of course, it doesn't necessarily. Social change is an incredibly complex problem of multiple factors interacting and counteracting and opposition and trying to find the levers that sometimes work and sometimes doesn't. And so, you know, kind of disappointing when actually that didn't work. What do we do now? Well, I mean, essentially they originally had planned to block part of the terrace, which is a major street in Wellington and which would have thrown transport in Wellington into chaos. It's a major thoroughfare. And then they spoke to some... As it was told to me, I didn't organise it, but they spoke to some experienced activists who weren't part of XR, but I think we're kind of from the anarchist tradition, so this really kind of anti-police vibe to them, which is sometimes valid. And they said, look, if you occupy that space, yes, you'll disrupt it, but the police are going to come in with their batons, they're going to kettle you, surround you, you're going to be trapped, it's going to be horrendous. And the XR people were still trying to... They had this idea of reds, orange, and greens, people that are willing to be arrested, people that are kind of meh, and a bunch of people that are more there for the fun, kids, they want to have that sort of space. So they wanted all those things to exist, and they got, as
as they understood what might happen if they occupied the terrace, that these green people, these kids, these people just wanted to sing and dance and protest and speak out, but didn't want to be arrested or beaten up by the police, that wouldn't work. And so they changed to this, it was Stout Street, which is a minor street coming off Lambton Quay. It wasn't a major thoroughfare. And the police, of course, just sat there and went, this doesn't bother us. We'll just see how long you stay here. We'll stand here and watch. And everyone's going, oh, now what do we do?
It's interesting the different forms of protest. Last week, or a couple of weeks ago, we had 35,000 people walking down George Street. You wouldn't describe the large amount of grey hair that was walking down the street as radicalised.
No, and I think the purpose of me, for my doctoral studies at least, the purpose of me having these conversations was to really frame where I stand on this idea of climate change, climate anger, eco anger, whatever you want to call it, however you want to frame it, but where do I actually stand on this? And I think that the way to start on it is, quote unquote, at the extremes of it, which would be, what does motivate, drive people to go literally put their body on the line for something?
New Zealand has a long history of protest. Is there something different happening now?
I think what's different is the level of intensity of it. It's almost like if you think of like protesting, traditionally it was around the idea, it was beer, rugby, religion, they were the classic things. The notion of protesting against something which is existential and abstracted becomes quite difficult. It's not a tangible thing that you can point to and show. And I think that's probably what's changing it. Within that, I was kind of curious as where the sort of start of quote unquote the radicalised movement of
But I think it was a bit of a change in thinking about what radicalism meant. Like it could have led to, okay, that didn't work, we need to ramp it up, we need to go back to being more disruptive and picking something way more a problem, the police will have to step in. And for example, that's what Restore Passenger Rail, which is now called Climate Liberation Aotearoa, that's what they did. They blocked motorways. And of course the police are there straight away, desperately trying to get out of the way because you're shutting down the whole transport system. And that involved some people who were from exile, like they kind of transitioned across, so they remained in both, and they did that kind of, well, this is what radicalism means for us. And again, that was an idea which came from the UK. The same guy that started XR, Roger Hallam, he started Just Stop Oil, and that's what they did. They blocked motorways and people get arrested and, all that sort of stuff. XR kind of didn't pursue that, and it didn't so much do that kind of, we're going to occupy Wellington and disrupt it. It kind of started to focus more on fossil fuel sites. So we had about 10-11 months later in Canterbury, the XR from Christchurch, along with XR people from other parts of the South Island, they occupied a coal mine that was a coal mine, so bad, but also it had been taking out of the ground far more than it was consented to do, like 10 times as much consented to do, which they picked up by watching these truck movements and figuring out that a truck holds so many tons of coal, and there were way more truck movements than there were supposed to be coal going out. And so they shut down the gate and occupied the inside of that mine. And then shortly after that, Dunedin XR, which I was involved in, they were, it's this coal train which goes from Takatimu Mine down in Southland and goes up to Clandeboy's milk drying factory near Temuka. And it goes through Dunedin on the way, and it's about five trains a week, and they each have sort of several hundred tons of coal, and it all gets burnt to dry milk for export to take the water out. And so Dunedin moved on to kind of thinking, well, we can target this train. It goes right through Dunedin, and so they about half a dozen times stopped it at the train station, and sometimes stopped it for sort of half an hour, 20 minutes, and then let it go. But several times stopped it for, for a day, and had people locked onto the tracks in front of it and people on top of it and stuff like that, which eventually led to people getting arrested. Mm. So there was kind of a switch to, rather than kind of shutting down a capital city and hoping the government responds when you just create chaos, to let's both try and increase the costs for these fossil fuel companies that are, you know, profiting from destroying our planet, but also really raising the profile and just saying to people, look, we're in a climate crisis and we're still burning a whole heap of coal, and we're burning coal because we export milk and that's a part of our economy we've built up, and that's a choice we've made, and we don't need to make that same choice. We could have made a different choice with what we do with our fields. We could grow, you know, crops and fruit and, you know, all the sort of things which wouldn't have all these negative.
How do you think that sits? Is there a continuum with Gandhi and Parihaka at one end? What's at the other end? Are people describing that other end?
Yeah, and that other end, interestingly enough, Andreas Malm, who's a Scando professor, and the last book that he wrote, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, he strongly advocates for direct action such as Extinction Rebellion. He maintains that without direct action, everything else becomes inconsequential. And so he has become almost a poster boy for direct action movements. So I asked Kyle, is there more need for direct violent action as advocated by Andreas Malm?
I mean, I think my master's is about nonviolence, so I think a lot about what is and isn't violence. And I would say...
That's probably a more appropriate question.
Yeah, I mean, I think largely I would say property damage isn't violence. There are some kind of complicated boundaries, like, you know, if someone needs to get to hospital and you blow up the road that goes to the hospital, well, people are going to negatively affected. You know, and there are always weird things, like, you know, if you occupy a road and there's an ambulance trying to get through and you prevent that ambulance getting through, are you being violent? But by and large, I think property damage isn't violence. And I think some of the most effective forms of activism I've seen, so take for example Mike Smith, who a few decades ago in the middle of the night climbed up One Tree Hill with a chainsaw and attacked the tree there and kind of half chopped it down, and there was outrage. This was a I guess probably a national symbol, particularly a symbol of Auckland. I mean, bizarrely, it was an exotic tree that he attacked. It wasn't a native, but you know, it was part of the Auckland identity. And he was released from jail, and the Holmes TV show, which was on then, approached him and said, can you come on? He said yes. He came on, and Paul Holmes is like, why the hell did you do this? This is terrible. And he said, well, the reason I did this is to get on your TV show, and here's the reason why. I'm going to tell you about colonization. I'm going to tell you about the thousands of hectares of forest which colonization has destroyed, and the animals, and, you know, all the stuff like that. And to me, that was an incredibly effective piece of activism, because it reminds us that the point isn't necessarily for everyone to get on side. Social change doesn't necessarily happen because 51% or more of people agree. You know, Martin Luther King was not popular until after the civil rights movement. Now he is 99% whatever revered, but at the time he was incredibly unpopular. He was called a communist. You know, if he'd stood for election, he would have lost in most places. The suffragettes, the same thing. Social change is, you know, often popular 20, 30, 50 years down the line, you know, and it's about trying to win it at the time. And that's not that can involve a popularity contest. Some of the things we have that have achieved social change are through kind of democratic elections. Nuclear Free New Zealand was kind of about getting Labour on board, and then they win the election and then they implement it and you keep the pressure on them to do it. But a lot of things aren't. It's about how can we make this so inconvenient for them that they want to make change. And so, I guess to come back to that question of to blow up a pipeline, sometimes I suspect that kind of property damage has value if you think about it creatively. You know, it can do it. New Zealand is pretty reticent on these things. Part of our cultural is very much attached to, I guess, private property, and you can't damage other people's private property, and so you have to be smart about it. I think Mike Smith was incredibly smart about it because he knew he was going to be incredibly popular, and he figured, despite that, how can I use this to get some people thinking about this key issue? And he, you know, he made a deliberate choice knowing that was going to happen. And as long as you go into it with your eyes open and say that's going to work, I don't think you should go blow up a pipeline and think, well, I'm going to be popular. You know, and you also, you know, because of the inequities in society, you can't go up a pipeline and think I'm going to achieve lots of material change. Like, I'm actually going to stop whatever's flowing in the pipeline or the coal in the train. Is, you know, that's still going to happen. So how do we use this one opportunity in a symbolic way to educate the public and make them aware that these things are going on and this is wrong, and and try and, you know, achieve change through kind of withdrawing social license and those sort of things.
We did some interviews with the people in the transition town people in Oamaru 10 years ago now. And at the time, I'm not sure if it still is, Oamaru was doing some really interesting things with changing how this town operates. And we went there looking for how is this big movement, what's going on. And it turned out to be less than 10 people getting on and living a better life, doing things, and the town was just like, okay, we'll do that too. People talk about it being, you know, 3.5% of the people need to change or make a difference. Why is it so slow?
Yeah, because I asked them that, because in actual fact, while statistically it said that it's 3.5%, when you break that 3.5% down, it's actually slightly less than that. So you would think it should be really easy to, like, you know, shift people's viewpoints on these. So I asked them.
So I've written about the 3.5% rule, because it's XR used it. It was one of their key things, and that's what they said when they were doing those mobilizations, is that all we need to do is we know how this many people is. In the UK, it was like 2 million. They never got close to that, but at least that's a target you can say, oh, that's theoretically possible, even if maybe practically not possible. The problem with the rule is that it all comes from data that from former Soviet Union states, autocratic regimes. So, you know, overthrowing the Marcos in the Philippines, Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, kind of African dictators, former, you know, Latvia, Estonia, when the Soviet Union, all this, that's the data that's used. None of it is Western liberal democratic states. No one's ever, that data has not been using that rule. So whether or not it applies to New Zealand is kind of an unknown question. And if you think of kind of large mobilizations in New Zealand that have been sustained in some way, which would probably eliminate things like school strike climate, which is kind of very occasional, big mobilization sometimes, but not any sustained anyway. You might think of, for example, the Springbok tour, where, you know, there was sort of a 8-week period where people were, there was a lot of full-on protest action nationwide, and, you know, depending how you measure success, if the measure of success was stopping the Springbok tour, completely unsuccessful. If the measure of success was New Zealand's not going to have another Springbok tour, successful. If the measure of success was kind of solidarity with people in Africa, and Nelson Mandela seeing it on the Waikato Test match on TV, for example, when he said something along the sun came out when that happened, that's successful. But if we think about kind of the stated goal was to stop the tour, not successful. So again, social change is complicated.
Let's have a music break. Who've you brought along?
Well, considering we're talking about rebellion and protest, I thought it appropriate that we have someone who was represents that. And so the usual ones come to mind: Rage Against the Machine, Bob Marley, etc., etc. But I found this remarkable musician called Yasmin Williams, and she was a very strong part of the 2020 protests surrounding George Floyd.
Thank you.
was sure then you were going to play Big Yellow Taxi. We mentioned before the protests in Dunedin. Did you ask Kyle about that?
I did, because I, you know, the feeling when you see 35,000 people up and arms walking down the street emotionally is quite, it's quite something. It's quite, it's something that really on a real base level you feel engaged with. And so I did ask Kyle, I said, look, does this form of protest actually do anything? Is it a good way to affect and force change?
I think that's interesting. I mean, I saw a lot of commentary after that happened about that's possibly the largest protest in Dunedin ever. I'm very confident it is, in terms of numbers, it is the largest protest in Dunedin by quite a considerable amount. I'm not aware we've ever had a protest of more than sort of 10,000 at any time. That's incredibly successful in terms of mobilisation, and it clearly highlights in a community a real anger and concern about what's been suggested about the hospital. So in terms of that kind of moral and potentially kind of democratic, this is going to cost you votes in an MMP election, that's all very, very useful. But we'd probably need to question the... do marches of that type and rallies and people expressing their concern and saying, no, they can't do this, the abilities of governments in particular to ignore that and to make kind of judgments about how are we happy for just to take these hits? What are our abilities for people to forget and us to turn them around when, you know, the next election is 2 years away and it won't cost us too much? And, you know, I suspect probably the national government and their partners, what are our priorities and, you know, where they're currently putting money is things like tax cuts and roads, not hospitals, for whatever reason. It's kind of insane for me, but they're obviously making some sort of judgment about what they think they can get away with and their priorities for what they're doing. So, but I think there is a overstated belief that mobilising people for a march or a rally or signing a petition or writing a letter is going to achieve change. At some stage, most things, you have to find some way to force change. You know, you have to stop something happening or make something so actually inconvenient that a government is forced to do something different. And I don't see anything of 35,000 people marching that, you know, they have options there. They might say, well, this is going to hurt us a bit, but we're willing to do it anyway. Whereas if you go and occupy every MP, national MP's office, or you go, you know, I've seen interesting things done overseas where activists do kind of really challenging things like target MP's homes, they kind of force a response. And I don't see a response from the government from this. They've been able to just ignore it as a problem. If you think about marches as a way, it's a way to mobilise a community, it's a way for you to judge your support, and I think the organisers have got a clear indication of the massive support they had, that's clear. It enables you to do so many things like, you know, building up a mailing list and helping move people from, you'll attend a march, to how do we get them to do something else? You know, I want them to write to Parliament, I want them to lobby their MP, whatever your next step is. If mobilize, you need to get hold of them in some way, and a march and a petition and that sort of stuff are ways to do that. So those are all kind of useful tools in terms of, and if you think about effective broadly, you know, it's effective in terms of achieving those things. But I think one of the ways you can tell you're effective is when you get a response. And, you know, the Restore Passenger Rail people, I didn't like the strategy of occupying the motorway, but they got a response, not only from the police, they got a response from the government who said, we're going to legislate and up the penalties here and we're going to put you in jail. So at least you know you're pissing them off. We are unhappy what you're doing, so we're going to have to do some response rather than we can ignore you. Being ignored is, that's a lot of effort for not much.
Not for the door, which is a shame, but you know.
That poses a real challenge, that if the stuff that does make a difference are the only 10, 15 people who were protesting at the oil conference in Dunedin, and that did get violent. There has to be a middle ground.
Well, no. No, there doesn't. Maybe there is no middle ground on this. And this is the polarity of this conversation is exactly that. When we come to later on, when we have the conversation with Rosemary, and we'll talk about that conference, she was involved in it in a very clever, witty way, I thought. But I don't think there is a middle ground on it, because the middle ground is just driving our cars every day like we do normally. And one of the things that Carl's putting across and saying, and this is backed up by the other interviews, is that the only way to force change is for it to be so disruptive for people, so uncomfortable, that they have to change. If it's not uncomfortable, and if it's not forcing them, the general population, to do things differently, then we'll just maintain the status quo.
So where does that leave you as a chef?
And that's a really, really good point.
You can't poison people.
I can't poison people. But as a chef, what I can do is I can facilitate some of those changes, particularly surrounding the notion of carbon, the effects of carbon and food chains, food waste. There are quite significant things I can do as a chef. As an educator, I can do even more. And the positioning of myself within this bell curve of change has been really shown through these conversations as to where I sit. And I do, I sit squarely in the middle of that bell curve. And I suppose for me, the argument is there more consequential change that can occur if you're in the middle of that bell curve rather than sitting out on the extremities of it?
A few weeks ago, I sent you a menu from a restaurant in Auckland.
Aye, yeah.
That has on it the food, and then it's got the miles. And I don't know that you're dismissive of it, but okay, let's go for you're dismissive of the impact of that.
Well, what's been shown is when, unfortunately, one of the things that's come out, the research shows that as soon as you start to put things like carbon miles, carbon footprint, food miles on a menu, people ignore it. It actually doesn't do anything. So for me, and I sound slightly cynical when I say that, it's a very astute marketing point to put that on the menu. The actual way to change that is to just be doing that as part of your practice as a good chef. That's what you should be doing. We should all be doing that. We should all be purchasing locally. We should all be trying to make sure that the supply chains for the food that we eat is shorter and smaller. It should be just the way that we operate, particularly in a place the size of New Zealand. You know, our supply chains, they're either very, very long, come from the other side of the world, or they're very, very short. So one of the things that's being challenged at the moment is this notion of science is overtaking the narrative of this change. And that's an example of it, I believe.
And you sent me a paper about the sort of food miles. And it was somebody who was saying the customers were finding, well, what am I supposed to do with this number? I'm out here to have dinner.
Yeah.
And you're telling me 1,000 bananas is a meaningless number. Is that a lot? Am I supposed to care?
Yeah, and the classic example of it is as soon as you do anything that looks punitive, people don't want to respond to it. And that was the kind of challenge that I had when I was having these conversations with, you know, Kyle and Rosemary and Jen, is what they are doing is inherently punitive. They're making it uncomfortable for other people, whereas for myself as a chef, you need to make it easy for people to make change. So there's a tension there that I had to navigate.
And somebody, Naomi Oreskes, I think, talks about the hyphenated activist, the activist lawyer, or the lawyer-activist, well, it's the same thing, whatever they might be. Are you getting closer to being an activist chef? Is that where you want to go?
I don't think it's where I want to go. But I did sort of say to Kyle, you know, how do you navigate this idea of being an activist / scholar?
I mean, it is an interesting exercise in how to maintain academic integrity and also some sort of activist moral standard and be part of a collective to which you feel you're contributing. Some of the things that I found really challenging with doing my research is, and partially it's, you know, a white male, and then you attach some, you know, kind of an activist background as well, along with other people. I wasn't the only one, but also then the academic, I'm researching social change. So all that adds up to a lot of people kind of trying to ask you, they'll say, you know, how about we do this? And then rather than having a general discussion, they would say, well, Kyle, what do you think about that? And they'd kind of give you priority. And I found that really frustrating. And I'd then deflect that and say, actually, I'd like everyone to discuss that. Like, you know, I think back to when school strike for climate started, no one, including me, would have thought that school strikes, because we've had school strikes before, people have tried that, it never worked. And then Greta Thunberg comes along and changes what we think about young people and social change. And before that happened in 2018, I would have gone, I don't know about that, that sounds a bit dubious. And then, what would I know? And, you know, same thing with Parihaka and Gandhi and woman suffrage, all those things. In some ways, what a lot of those people are doing are experimenting and trying the things that you think can't work and trying to figure out which of them actually can't work.
Tim, you were talking before about the tension, the perhaps conundrum of the chef and the hospitality is about manaakitanga, it's about welcoming, helping people feel comfortable, and yet we've got this challenge of we need to move people out of that comfort zone. We're satisfizers, we're complacent, we'll carry on doing the thing we're doing because it's the thing we're doing. Did you have a discussion with Kyle about the triggers to move from, yeah, I'm just happy doing what I'm doing, even if I know it's wrong, to actually doing something?
Yeah, I did. Because for myself, I wanted to understand what some of those triggers are. And the same things that I asked Rosemary and Jean as well. What triggers you? What is the emotional state they're in that makes you want to go out and protest so loudly, so angrily? What is it that makes that occur?
I mean, I think one of the things is that good activists or organisers or whatever you want to call yourself do is make things relevant for people. And a hospital feels relevant to a community, right? You know, most people will have been to the hospital either themselves or to see some family member. They know how important that is and is likely to be for them at some stage in their life. You know, you want to turn up the emergency department and know you're going to better get in and not wait 12 hours and get cancer treatment and, you know, all those sort of things. So that's an easy pull. That's an easy to pull things out on the street. Climate change is a lot more challenging. One of the things we know about climate change is that kind of activism and people's concern about climate change, you can track it based on disasters, for example. So immediately after flooding and heavy rain events and all the news stories saying, well, this is worse because of climate change, we know that people express more concern, they do more Google searches, they're more likely to do activism, all those sort of things. So there are practical elements, but one of the challenges is how to make, you know, this is a serious problem. How do you make it relevant for you being possibly not white, middle class, educated? You know, the communities that are going to be affected in Dunedin primarily by climate change are going to start with South Dunedin, some of who are wealthy beachfront properties, but some of who are Caversham, low-lying, and their flooding is going to get worse, that sort of stuff. And make it relevant and then help you find a pathway to have some sort of democratic engagement with that so that you can have some control over, at the very least, what your community, what your country is doing. There's a lot of debates about what works, and a lot of what the science psychologists and stuff have said to us a long time, you shouldn't lead with fear. Fear doesn't encourage people's responses. People withdraw, they get scared, and so they get defensive. And then Greta Thunberg came along and said, I'm terrified, and then all of you are going to come with me, and she mobilised millions of people. So now people are going, hang on a minute, how does this work? You said fear doesn't work, and part of what she does. And there's all kind of human economics, nudge theory stuff, which is, you know, all very well researched and interesting and stuff. But again, often, or it often relates to kind of economic measures. How do we make people have this kind of simple response by altering their behaviour in economic ways, or getting them to make better health decisions. It's not. I don't think it's so much studied in terms of how do we get somebody, mobilise somebody in a political way, and in an effective way. That is kind of, as my understanding, less studied, and it's more challenging to study. Politics is. I mean, if you want, how do I make somebody smoke less or quit smoking? That's a relatively easy thing for some sort of psychologist or whatever health professional to study. How do I change behaviour to change the world? Well, there are a million factors there, and that's really complicated, right? So that's, yeah, more challenging to understand. And I think that's the area we're still flying around in, is what is effective.
So, Tim, you've been talking with Kyle Mackies, who is a researcher in protest.
His PhD doctorate was on Extinction Rebellion, and he was looking at it from a Foucauldian point of view, which is the relationship between knowledge and power and how those interplay. And specifically, he was working within Extinction Rebellion while he was doing his PhD. So the thing that I was kind of curious about is, what does activism, protesting, look like in a modern, contemporary New Zealand going forward?
I would like to think that we take more learnings from Indigenous people in New Zealand, that Māori have this really proud history of activism, often very effective, sometimes over very long time periods. But in terms of turning back a lot of colonisation, protecting language, Waitangi Tribunal, protecting up some various last bits of land, and if you look at the last government, kind of getting things like co-governance and, you know, trying to think about the treaty and political terms on board, Māori of over 180 or so years of resistance have been pretty effective. And so thinking about what that means for Pākehā here, I think, is important, particularly land occupations. You know, if there was a Pākehā often, I think we often as Pākehā think in very short time frames. If we can shut this thing down for a day, we're doing well. And if you think about the occupation of Ahumato, they were occupying that for years, and then they reoccupied it, and by the time they went to reoccupy it and the police kicked them off, so many people knew about it that 10,000 people turned up in the weekend to support them. And if 10,000 people turn up, the police are going to go, well, actually, we've got limited options here, we can't hold back 10,000 people. There's kind of a people power there that is effective. And so thinking about what that means for wider movements in New Zealand, beyond kind of, yeah, I can introduce myself in Māori, I can pay respect to Treaty of Waitangi. What does it actually mean in terms of strategy? What does a hikoi mean if Pākehā take it on, for example? How would we think about that? Is that cultural appropriation, or is that something maybe that we could work with Māori and say, well, what is a way that we can work together and do those sort of things? What would it mean to occupy land and say, actually, this coal mine here, this is not yours anymore, we're taking this over for Aotearoa, for our future, because of what you're doing, and we're going to stay here and we're not going. I mean, we have sat back and over 40 years, we've watched poverty and inequality and benefits and that sort of stuff just devastate a whole underclass in New Zealand, which is now multi-generational, and yet you say you're going to downgrade our hospital and you better watch out because we're all coming for you. So you know, how to get the issues that mobilise people is one of those things. And, you know, I think it's kind of a bit of a disgrace that we have not done better by, you know, our underclass and poverty, and that we've just let these people live in the system that drags them down for decades. But clearly New Zealanders can be mobilised. So it's thinking about how do we make this relevant and make people feel frustrated about, and go from fine about casual, oh yeah, she'll be right, to no, that annoys me and I'm going to do something about it, because there is definitely is a sense of social justice and wrongness in New Zealand, which is quite strong. It's just how to activate it, I think, is the challenge.
So, Tim, we've got two more to come in this series. What's the takeaway so far?
Well, the takeaway so far is that societal change is a delicate thing. And it requires the confluence of many pressures to occur. And it's not simple. That's definitely one of the things that's come out of it. Also, the effectiveness of protests are uncomfortable. Protest activism in and of itself highlights what people don't want to hear. It's not something that makes people popular. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It makes people unpopular. And for people to willingly accept that they're going to be sort of on the outskirts of society because of their beliefs that they believe so strongly that they're willing to protest, I'm still trying to decide within myself whether that is something that we should admire or if it's something that we should ignore.
I look forward to next week. Who is it next week?
So next week I think we'll talk about Rosemary. Rosemary's a remarkable person, such an interesting conversation, really frames this notion of the motivation that's required to be an activist, to be so active in protesting. Incredible lady, so elegant, so well spoken. I felt really like we should have been having Devonshire tea or something while discussing, not talking about what it's like super gluing yourself to a motorway.
Thank you very much for that. You bring along good music, Tim. What else have you got?
Well, I thought we'd carry on with the theme of protest. So this is Spoiled Pan.
I'm just a bottom feeder, scum of the earth, and I'm cursed with the burden of empathy. My fellow humans matter to me. I'm a bottom feeder, scum of the earth, and I'm cursed, and I'm cursed.
To Blowing Bubbles, brought to you by Sustainable Management, brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Roving reporter and researcher Tim Lynch. So that was Blowing Bubbles. I'm Tim Lynch. We hope you enjoyed the show.
I wanna be an ignorant! Let's run out the door like a business! Trickle down like the chin of my mistress!
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.